I'm Afshin Ratansi, and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the UAE amidst continuing NATO disarray over Trump peace plans for Ukraine and continuing UK-US-EU armed Israeli war crimes in Palestine. Today, the UN Security Council meets to discuss the Israeli invasion of Lebanon and the UN's so-called peacekeeping forces, whose mandate expires next week. This is presumably if Israel has not yet again begun NATO armed bombing of Iran amidst its NATO armed bombing of Syria and Yemen. As we approach the two-year anniversary of the latest Israeli campaign against Palestinians, even diehard Zionists are complaining about Israel's crimes, with some NATO countries performatively denying some weapons to the Netanyahu government. Even Donald Trump, the chief sponsor of starvation and war crimes, has warned that his MAGA base is starting to hate Israel. Joining me now from Tel Aviv is Netanyahu's predecessor, former Prime Minister of Israel, Ehud Olmert. He led Israel's failed 2006 war in Lebanon, imposed the blockade on Gaza, and launched Operation Cast Lead, killing more than 1,400, including 344 children, before his resignation in 2009. Former Prime Minister, thank you so much for coming back on. By the time this is being broadcast, we don't know whether 60,000 Israeli Jewish reservists may have been sent into Gaza City. You appear to have backed Netanyahu's war of extermination, as you now call it, in Palestine when it first began. Now you call it criminal, and you're also quoting what supporters of Netanyahu call Hamas health ministry statistics. Why do you call it criminal now, and how many have been killed or wounded in Gaza?
Well, you'd allow me to correct some inaccuracies in your presentation, if you don't mind. I never say that originally the war was a war of extermination. In the beginning, certainly in October of 2023, the war was unavoidable and inevitable. You would recall that it all started because of this atrocious, barbaric, horrific attack of Hamas killing 1,200 Israeli citizens in their homes, in the living rooms, in the bedrooms, children, the mothers and elderly people, butchering them, slaughtering them, beheading them, raping them.
Well, the rape allegations, as you know, are highly controversial.
No,
but anyway, you don't believe that October the 7th, the atrocities...
Excuse me. No, we have an agreement that I have the right to...
Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you very much. The raping was absolutely done, unfortunately, and the beheading was done, and the putting children into stoves and burning them alive was done in the most horrific manner by Hamas, and it definitely justified a reaction of Israel and a military reaction in order to reach out to the murderers and the killers of Hamas. And unfortunately, it's true that Hamas was hiding and embedded inside the most densely populated area in Gaza, inside private homes, mosques, hospitals, schools, public facilities, on ground, underground. And so it was evident from the outset that there will be a collateral damage, which was unavoidable considering the circumstances. When related to the war at that time, I certainly justified it, as did all the world leaders, starting with President Biden, with Prime Minister Sunak in Great Britain, President Macron, and all the others in Europe, everywhere. What I'm saying about it now is 22 months after the beginning, when 70% of the Gazan buildings are destroyed, when so many Gazans were killed. Some of them were Hamas murderers, and they definitely deserved their punishment. But there were many more that were non-involved, which is regrettable, certainly. Question now is, at this time, when there is not any objective which is worth the cost, when it is absolutely evident, as all of the experts in Israel, including all of the former commanders of the Israeli army and the Israeli Mossad and the security services, thousands of the most distinguished and revered Israeli soldiers signed a petition asking the government not to go into a death threat that will cost the lives of Israeli soldiers, of the hostages, and of non-involved Palestinians, this at this time, under these circumstances, is a crime which has to be avoided, and I'm against it.
Yeah, I mean, I was interrupting because there's been a lot of controversy, and it's been aired in the Israeli press, in Haaretz and others,
maybe
October 7th.
Maybe in some places.
Well, it's what you wrote. You wrote in Haaretz. It's that newspaper, actually.
I wrote exactly about that stage, which, as I said, I'm opposed to and I disagree with, and I think it's not justified and unnecessary, and there is no good goal that can justify this operation. In this context, this is criminal, and I'm against it.
I mean, clearly, you're not a supporter of Netanyahu. You don't go as far as believing, I don't know, do you believe the Hannibal Doctrine was used on October the 7th? Do you believe that intelligence agencies in Israel were really as incompetent as they are being painted out to be on October the 7th, that day?
No, I don't think that there was... I think it's been proved that the incompetence of the Israeli intelligence was not as a result of a lack of any information that we possessed. We knew everything, exactly what the Hamas were preparing. It was just the arrogance and the complacency and the overconfidence of the Israeli leadership, which didn't trust that Hamas will do what they were actually doing, and therefore the Israeli army was not ready on the borderline in order to defend itself. And it allowed the Hamas to do what they did. But don't get it wrong. It was not a result of any incompetence of the Israeli intelligence. I think it proved itself massively in this operation, in what we did in Gaza, including the elimination of all the leaders of Hamas, including Yahya Sinwar and Mohammed Deif, and Ismail Haniyeh and Mohammed Sinwar and all the others, including what we did in Lebanon with Hezbollah, what we did in Iran, in Tehran. So I don't think that the problem was intelligence. The problem was arrogance, incompetence, and a certain disregard of the abilities of Hamas to wage the kind of war that they waged, which was, from their point of view, a great success. Unfortunately, in the most brutal manner, which necessitated the Israeli reaction.
But you believe it's an unfounded conspiracy theory to suggest that Netanyahu, for his own personal reasons, de facto allowed October 7th to happen to save his own political career?
Oh, look, there are many accusations levied against Netanyahu, and I certainly support some of the accusations, some of the arguments against him, he ignored for a very long time the Palestinian Authority, which was the natural partner for political negotiations. I negotiated with the Palestinian Authority. I negotiated with President Dr. Mahmoud Abbas, and I proposed to him a comprehensive political solution on the basis of two states. Netanyahu preferred to flirt with Hamas. He believed that if he will somehow negotiate with or support financially the Hamas, they will be deterred from launching a military attack against Israel. And therefore, there was an indifference, and complacency, and arrogance that brought about this outcome. But there was no... I never went as far as saying that there was some kind of a conspiration between Hamas and Netanyahu. No, there was a failure of Netanyahu, a failure which deserves his overthrow from his position as prime minister.
In fairness to Netanyahu, and I did ask Ehud Barak on this program, of course, your predecessor, that, of course, there were close relations in terms of funding between the Israeli government and Hamas. But I do want to get to today, but your government...
I mentioned it myself, that Prime Minister collaborated with Qatar to provide the financial support for Hamas, believing that perhaps he can buy some kind of test cooperation with Hamas, by providing him with the facilities and with the financial support. It was brought in suitcases with cash of millions of hundreds of millions of dollars to Hamas. This was a terrible mistake. As a result of what I said, the desire of Netanyahu not to negotiate with the Palestinian Authority, but to rather kind of flirt with Hamas, which is a terrorist organization that is not interested, never wanted to negotiate with Israel. So that have kept him away from a possible international pressure to negotiate for territorial concessions to the Palestinians as part of a comprehensive peace with the Palestinian Authority. And that has shifted the emphasis of Israel to the kind of relations with Hamas, which proved to be disastrous.
Now, you still stand by your own descriptions of what is going on under the Netanyahu government in Gaza as concentration camps in Rafah, ethnic cleansing, deliberate starvation, because you know that Jewish Zionist groups in the NATO countries supplying the weapons would call you an anti-Semite if you were saying this in those countries.
Well, I have to correct the inaccuracies. All these terms of concentration camps or ethnic cleansing are the terminology which were used when people like you, anchors, very able, fluent, and sophisticated anchors on the televisions, ask me, do you think that this is an ethnic cleansing? I said, no, it's not. There is not a policy of ethnic cleansing. It may be interpreted as such if there will be a deportation of Gazans from where they live or where they're supposed to live now to the south part of Gaza and creating a humanitarian camp which is completely segregated without any freedom of movement for the Palestinians. If that will take place, it can be easily interpreted as ethnic cleansing, but it didn't take place yet. So, you know, we hope it will not. And we do everything we can in order to prevent it.
But you've come under a huge attack from those supporting Netanyahu as being a Hamas apologist, almost, even though...
Yeah, I know. I'm not a Hamas supporter. I've been fighting Hamas without any hesitations at the time that I was prime minister. You mentioned it, the Qassrid operation. Not that we killed so many Palestinians, and there was not any charge against me at the time that we deliberately killed innocent Palestinians in Gaza. But we had to fight against Hamas because they were shooting rockets against Israeli settlements after we pulled out completely from Gaza. I was a major part of the Israeli disengagement from Gaza because I didn't want to have Israeli settlements in Gaza. And we pulled out completely, and Hamas continued to shoot the rockets on a daily basis against Israeli civilian settlements all over the place. So we had to fight it. But we fought in an entirely different manner without the same kind of events which perhaps can be described or characterize the present battles that we have with them.
Ehud Olmert, I'll stop you there. More from Israel's former prime minister after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with Israel's former Prime Minister, Ehud Olmert. Former Prime Minister, you've said that Israel is close to civil war. Why did you say that? And is that because there's a growing realization in Israel that, for instance, I don't know, the leaks to Israel's Channel 13, the cabinet minutes, meeting minutes showing that Netanyahu sabotaged negotiations, unilaterally breaking a ceasefire in March, beginning his starvation campaign? Or what exactly is the reason for Israel being at the brink of civil war?
Well, definitely Israel is, Israeli society is polarized. I mean, when you see 500,000 Israelis marching and rioting, demonstrating in the center of Tel Aviv, in Jerusalem, and hundreds of thousands cross-country from north to south because they oppose the government and they think that the war should end immediately and that the hostages, all of them, alive and dead, should be returned back to Israel, and the government seems to not to want it. This is a very, very deep and painful and heartbreaking controversy And this, together with the efforts made by the government to change the legal system and somehow damage the basic values of democratic lives that characterize the state of Israel from its inception. This is bringing the different parts of our society into the almost the edge, which can hopefully not, but which may end up with a violent confrontations within Israel, which we hope to avoid.
What, because they're against the starvation? I mean, I'm speaking to you from GCC country. I mean, Saudi Arabia's MBS has called it a genocide. We had Professor Omer Bartov on last week's episode from Brown University, the Holocaust scholar, former IDF soldier. He calls it a genocide. Why don't you call it a genocide? And is there a growing realization there is a genocide?
No, because I don't think there is a genocide.
Because there's no intent. Because there's no intent.
There is no intent. There is no policy. I can reassure you. And I'm, you know, as you said, I'm accused by some of the supporters of Netanyahu, the coalition side, as a supporter of Hamas. So you don't suspect that I'm trying to defend the government when it does not deserve to be defended. But there is not a policy of genocide. There is not even a policy of committing war crimes in purpose. There has never been any decision or order given to the Israeli fighters to kill indiscriminately Palestinians. No, that doesn't mean that crimes are not committed, but that it definitely there is not a policy by the government or by the high command of the Israeli army to kill innocent people. That doesn't mean that innocent people were not killed and the numbers are exorbitant, and this is not something that can be tolerated or even should be forgiven considering the circumstances at present time. But there is not a policy of genocide. There hasn't been genocide. There were many, many victims, casualties, people that were killed.
How many is your number killed so far in Gaza?
I don't know. You know, how do I know?
You said 60,000.
No, I just repeated the numbers, the figures that are written and are voiced out by people like you and others that they seem to think that they know exactly. I don't know. I don't want to commit myself to any particular number. I think I'm absolutely confident that too many people were killed. Too many non-involved people were killed, far beyond what I think is necessary or can be justified given the circumstances that we have. But I don't know figures. I didn't count them, and I don't know who did, and I don't know whether at all is it possible even to really reach in a specific, you know, accurate number. But grossly speaking, I mean, there are many different agencies and sources that talk about 60,000. So I accept this as a possible number, but I don't know.
So you believe that it's just rhetorical flourishes when Netanyahu says Amalek, when Smotrich talks about the need to, the actual word, commit genocide. This is just rhetoric. It doesn't display intent.
Oh, yes. Look, first of all, I warn you, you will not force me to defend Netanyahu or Smotrich.
No, I don't think you are going to.
Don't try. You will not succeed. But I'm not responsible. I don't know, and I don't judge the specific words. It is obnoxious and outrageous and totally unacceptable, and I oppose this rhetoric, and I fight vehemently here and everywhere, and I am accused, you know, of why do you have to say it when you are interviewed in Dubai or in Al Arabiya or in some other places? I say because I want that everyone, every Arab, every Muslim person in every Arab capital, in every Arab city, will know that they are Israelis, and some very well-known Israelis, not just the other person in the street, that are opposed to this. they do not share the rhetoric of Smotrich and Ben-Gvir and Netanyahu, and that they are prepared to spell it out everywhere they can, because we want that people will know that the voice coming from Israel is a different voice. And the values which we represent are the genuine values of what Israel was and should be.
Well, you've been condemning the violence of the settlers in the West Bank, away from Gaza.
Sure. But well, I mean, absolutely.
But when you were prime minister, the numbers of settlers went up by 40,000 between 2006 and 2009.
No. Listen, why do you have to stretch it beyond a reasonable limit? At the time that I was prime minister, I think that there was a tiny number. I don't want even to argue about it. The fact is that I proposed to the Palestinian Authority an Israeli withdrawal from 95.4% of the total territory of the West Bank, and I proposed that this territory, which will be annexed to the State of Israel, will be swapped so that an equal-sized territory from what was part of Israel until 67 will become part of a Palestinian state. I also proposed that the Arab side of Jerusalem will be the capital of Palestine. I also proposed to the Palestinians that the old city of Jerusalem will not have an exclusive political sovereignty, neither of Palestine nor of Israel, which is a huge revolutionary change in the attitude that was until then expressed by Israel. And I proposed it as part of a comprehensive agreement between us and Palestine. And regrettably, unfortunately, the president of the Palestinian Authority failed to sign, failed to say yes. He always reminded me afterwards that he never said no, which is true. He never said no. However, he never said yes. And in 2008, September of 2008, there was an historic opportunity to sign a peace treaty that would have ended the historic conflict between us and the Palestinians. And due to the failure and the lack of leadership and the lack of courage and vision by the Palestinians, not by us, it didn't work out, unfortunately.
I think the Palestinian Authority said they needed a map. But on the other hand, do you believe that because you saw it...
I knew that you are going to fail into this stupid trap, and you are falling into it. So let me put it up as it was. I presented a map which was prepared by the Israeli Intelligence Department, a comprehensive, large map which presented exactly all the offers of the 4.4%, 4.8% annexation of three centers in the West Bank and the swap of territories from what Israel was before 1967. I presented it to Mahmoud Abbas and I said, here, this is it. As part, of course, of all the other parts of the discussions. And he said, let me take it. I said, you can take it if you will sign it. Because I knew that if he will take it unsigned, he will disappear, as he actually did. And he will take this map, and then 2 years later, 3 years later, he will come to the then Prime Minister of Israel and will say, okay, this I already had from the previous governments. Now let's start from here and see what else you give us. So I didn't want to do it. Now, all this urban legend about the napkins, which apparently I offered him, I mean, this is nonsense. When Abu Mazen came back to Ramallah and he said, Olmert showed me the map. But he didn't give me the map because I didn't want to sign. So they asked him what was in the map. So he drew something on a napkin. And then the urban legend was that I gave him a napkin. Ridiculous. Nonsense. Never was.
Okay, well, I mean, do you think because you were making even those concessions, you personally have been targeted politically by some kind of deep state within Israel because you were seeking this two-state solution of yours?
Look, there was opposition, there were conspiracies. I never used the term deep state. I referred to specifically those who were spending millions of dollars in order to overthrow me, yes, to get rid of me because they were afraid that I'm inclined and I'm going to, and they knew that I was very serious because they never was hiding my intentions. I said from the outset, even before the election, in which I was elected prime minister, I said, I'm going to pull out from most of the territories. I'm going to divide Jerusalem into the natural division, which is the Jewish part, which will remain under Israeli sovereignty, and the Arab part, which will become the Palestine's capital. And so there were many factions, particularly the right wing, extreme right wing, and some rich Jews from overseas that supported them with financial sources in order to overthrow me. And they were successful, unfortunately.
Because, of course, the Jerusalem Post reported on your name being linked to Epstein, and we had Unit 8200's
Just finally,
we're running towards the end. We had Ari Ben-Benashi on, who said that Netanyahu, there are forces blackmailing Trump. And I know you see Trump as the only solution to what's happening in Gaza. That's why Trump is allowing the slaughter to continue in Gaza. He's being blackmailed over Epstein.
Number one, someone made a mistake, and instead of saying Ehud Barak, he said Ehud Olmert. The truth was that Barak was accused of being in partnership, in some kind of partnership with Epstein, but I am absolutely confident, absolutely, and you know I'm not a friend of Barak, but I have to say that he had nothing to do with any of the things that the criminal violations which were attributed to Epstein. He knew Epstein. I may have, by coincidence, may have met him. I never did.
So that's financial impropriety rather than sexual problems.
As I said again, I don't know exactly. There were all kinds of stories that Barak was somehow connected with him. I am absolutely confident. And I know Barak very well. And I'm not a friend of his, you know. And he never had anything to do with all the other things which are attributed to Epstein, and I think this is all nonsense. This is part of the kind of the efforts made by political rivals of Barak, myself, others, to try and link us somehow to all this. It's absolutely nonsense.
We're out of time. Former Prime Minister, thank you.
Thank you.
That's it for the show. Our continued condolences to those bereaved by the UK-US-EU armed genocide in Gaza. We'll be back on Saturday. Until then, keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country, and head to our channel, Going Underground TV on Rumble.com, to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Saturday.